The following is a presentation of Wisconsin Public Television.
Do you think we should increase welfare benefits?
No.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to Weekend. I'm Lynn Sprangers.
And I'm Dave Iverson. Happy holidays.
Hey, happy holiday to you, too.
And speaking of holidays, it is the shopping season. And for some of us, that means that we're still a little bit behind. So before we get... Yes?
I'm all finished, Dave.
Oh, well, I'm behind. Forgive me. I am behind. So anyway, before we get to the real business of tonight's program, we thought we would take a look at why men in particular are such lousy shoppers.
Dr. Sybil Payne of the Wisconsin Institute of Male Purchasing Patterns.
We've interviewed hundreds of men in order to determine the basic factors that are found in the poor male shopper. These interviews of various males picked at random have resulted in a profile of the shopping impaired male and the reasons underlying this dysfunctional behavior.
I had a best friend when I was a kid named Curtis, and Curtis and I were always very competitive. And I thought, you know, it's been many years, we should bury the hatchet, so I have these trophies from when I beat him in swimming events, and I thought I'd just take a nail and scratch out my name and put in his. My wife also needs a coat this winter, and she showed me at the store, and I thought, well, all she really needs to do is to keep warm. So I got some solar paneling from the house, and with the tax break I get for that, I get some really great golf clubs I've been keeping my eye on. I'm a member of the Symphony Committee, and I want the chairman to like me, and I know he plays a lot of squash, so I was driving by this garage sale, and this is an official Babs Bolero bowling pin signed by Babs, and it only cost me $10, and I thought, you know, he'll like me more.
It is our hope that by providing this information, we will be able to help those males suffering from this dysfunction.
Honey, hi, listen. It's Christmas Eve. Stores only open a couple hours. What do you want?
Madison Comedy Sports Team, providing the answer to the question inquiring minds want to know why men are such lousy shoppers. Lynn.
Okay, Dave, and before we get to, that is the beginning to our show, a little bit of a holiday beginning for you, but the real business of tonight's program is some bad news this week for General Motors, but as we understand, the Janesville plant appears to be safe. We'll talk about why. And later, we'll talk about both welfare and health care reform. Congressman Jim Moody joins us for that talk. And is the UW in for its own version of Stanford Gate, the practice of billing the feds for questionable university expenses? Those stories and some thoughts on why Mario didn't run, all on tonight's edition of Weekend.
It's the holiday edition of Weekend. Also tonight, guest panelist Stephen King. No, not that Stephen King.
For weeks, we all followed what came to be called the Mario scenario. Now it's over, of course, as the governor of New York announced this afternoon that he will not run for the presidency because of ongoing budget problems in his home state of New York.
It's my responsibility as governor to deal with this extraordinarily severe problem. Were it not, I would travel to New Hampshire today and file my name as a candidate in its presidential primary. That was my hope, and I prepared for it. But it seems to me I cannot turn my attention to New Hampshire while this threat hangs over the head of the New Yorkers that I've sworn to put first.
The thoughts today of New York Governor Mario Cuomo. We'll get some additional reaction now from our political panelists, Bill Dixon, Ed Garvey, and guest panelist, the real Stephen King. Thanks for coming tonight. Ed Garvey, are you the only Democrat in America who is delighted this evening that Mario Cuomo is out?
Well, I am
not delighted that he's out, because if Mario Cuomo were elected president, I'd be dancing in the streets. But I think that in many ways he would have been the most difficult Democrat to elect because of the problems in New York. And being a Tom Harkin supporter, I'm pleased, because there were lots of people who were waiting to declare themselves for Harkin who said, wait until Mario makes a decision.
Why Cuomo for Harkin? Why is that trade going to occur?
Well, clearly, I think Tom Harkin is the only real progressive in the race, and Cuomo would have taken the same stand on most issues. He's not, sort of that middle of the road neoliberal Democratic Leadership Council
like the
Clinton.
People that Dixon likes.
Right,
Clinton,
exactly.
Clinton and Kerry.
Mario, we hardly knew ye. But Ed, how can you say that Cuomo could not have been elected or would have had a difficult time to get elected, and he's closest to Harkin, but Harkin has a good chance of being elected? I mean, you're caught in a box, Ed. We're not going to elect Hubert Humphrey in 1992. You might as well understand that.
Well, the problem that Cuomo had is that he's a governor of a huge state with enormous problems, and all that Roger Ailes would have had to do is take a video cam through New York City and say, this is what he did for New York, imagine what he could do for Omaha. And so they would have used the same tactics against Cuomo that they did against the former governor of Massachusetts.
Meanwhile, Steve King, former U.S. Senate candidate, former Republican state chair, is over there smiling. This has got to be good news for the Republican Party, right?
I don't know if it's good news or not. I think Governor Cuomo was actually scared out at the prospect of having to debate Pat Buchanan in the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
No, I suspect it is. The Democrats lost an articulate voice, and the president probably lost some competition.
What does this change in terms of the Wisconsin primary, open primary again, of course? How does it change the dynamics and the importance, Bill, of the Wisconsin primary?
Well, at the risk of Ed Garvey saying I'm talking inside baseball, the fact is it diminishes the importance of the Wisconsin primary, because New York is on the same day, April 7th, and if Cuomo was in, New York would have been less important and the nation would have focused here in Wisconsin. So I think it diminishes the importance of...
Because now New York's up for grabs, and because we share that same date, people are going to be spending time there.
My candidate in 1984, Gary Hart, won Wisconsin. He lost New York, and the whole national press the next day was Hart loses New York. Not a word about Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. What's going to happen, do you think, now in Wisconsin? How does this change the dynamics? Talk a little about each of your candidates, Clinton and Kerry, two of your favorites, Bill. What do they do now to capture the Harkin supporters that Ed says now get such a plus?
Well, they continue to fight on a future versus status quo ticket. I think Tom Harkin wants it fought on a right-left ticket. Steve, your man Pat Buchanan, I think, is fighting for the soul of real conservatism.
Absolutely.
In 1996. So the Republican primary will be fought on a right-left center axis. I think Harkin wants to fight on a right-left axis.
I think
Clinton and Kerry will want to talk about the future versus the terrible status quo.
I think what Clinton and Kerry want to do is muddy the water and say, gee, I'm almost Republican, but not quite. And what Tom Harkin is doing is saying, look, people are suffering out here. Their health care, jobs, and this terrible economic system that has given all the breaks to the wealthy. And that's going to be a message, strangely enough, somewhat similar to Buchanan.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Pat Buchanan. All those themes you just mentioned, by the way, we're going to be covering on the program this evening, so it'll be interesting to see how those come out. But is Pat? What do Wisconsin Republicans think about Pat Buchanan, Steve?
I'm not that in touch with Wisconsin Republicans anymore, but I can tell you that nationally, Bill is absolutely right. It's the battle in New Hampshire, and it's really going to be waged in New Hampshire and may not even get to Wisconsin, but it's going to be based on a left-right axis. Absolutely.
In the Republican Party.
In the Republican Party.
Is he for real? Is Pat Buchanan
absolutely
for real?
I think he's for real.
Is
yep.
that?
Yep. I think Pat Buchanan is trying to deliver a message.
Steve, what do you say to people like me who say in private and occasionally publicly say, there isn't a dime's bit of difference between many of the views that Pat Buchanan holds and David Duke holds?
Oh, I think that's an outrage. Obviously, that implies that Pat Buchanan is some kind of racist or something like
I'm
that.
I'm not saying his past. I'm saying his code talk, like how could we assimilate a million Zulus? I mean, you choose Zulus intentionally. There's talk like that he engages in perhaps too frequently, I believe.
No, I think Pat Buchanan is simply trying to articulate the Reagan message of the 1980s.
All right. What's interesting is that it seems to me that what everyone's recognizing, including Buchanan, is that George Bush has just become totally without any ability to articulate a message at all. He's just kind of drifting with the flow of things, and it'll be, to me, it's almost reminiscent of when they took on Lyndon Johnson in '68. over the war. Now they're taking on...
You are back in the 60s.
I probably am. It's comfortable, too.
All right. We'll recycle through all of these themes throughout the program tonight, and we'll get back to all of you at the end. Thanks. Thanks for coming, Steve.
Coming up next on Weekend, the impact of the General Motors plant closings on the national and state economies.
General Motors announced a massive layoff that will eliminate 21 plants and 74,000 jobs in the next 4 years. It means that the one-time king of American automakers will wind up with a workforce half the size it was just 6 years ago. What will the layoffs mean for the GM plant in Janesville? Well, right now the plant has at least two things going for it. It has new leading-edge technology, and it manufactures a popular truck line. Accordingly, most automotive experts believe the Janesville plant will be spared the massive cutbacks. Similarly, the Oak Creek and AC Delco electronics plant, which is a subsidiary of GM, should also survive, at least for the time being. Joining us from Milwaukee, Claire Zempel, who's an economist with Robert W. Baird, and Matt Joseph, who's an automotive historian and who understands how cars work and why the industry sometimes doesn't. Matt is also the co-host of About Cars on Wisconsin Public Radio. Claire Zempel, let's begin first with some pretty important economic news that unfolded just today, and that is, of course, the Federal Reserve's decision to drop the prime rate by a full percentage point for its best customers, the discount rate, I should say. And we keep hearing that this is all it's going to take to help jumpstart our economy and, of course, the automobile industry. What can this do that the other cuts haven't done so far?
Well, really, this takes us to the magnitude of interest rate cuts that we've seen coming out of past recessions. Up until now, we really haven't seen the size of the discount rate cut approach that we saw back in 1982, 1975, and so forth. Even though interest rates have been coming down for several years, it's only now that we have a true substantial easing on the part of the Fed, bringing interest rates in line with the rate of inflation, lowering the real cost of short-term borrowing. So we're at a new trigger point that ought to be enough to shock the economy into moving upward.
Matt Joseph, you said to me earlier, the announcement that came out of General Motors this week was no surprise to anybody who'd been watching what was going on in the industry. It was really just an aftermath.
Yes, in 1990, November of 90, GM took a $3.3 billion charge and outlined pretty much the program that was outlined on Thursday. The difference this time is that, I should say Wednesday, but the difference this time is there's been a little added to it. This was mostly a repackaging of what was already known to try and head off a further degradation of GM's bond rating, something that would be terribly costly to GM.
And as we know, Claire Zempel, that bond rating is crucial and a reason why we now see a General Motors that's half of what it once was.
That's right, and General Motors is downsizing for a new economic world. They're cutting out about 20% of their capacity. They're readying themselves to break even in a year in which the nation sells about 13.5 million cars and trucks. And that's down from peak levels of sales in excess of 16 million. So there's an expectation in this decision that the level of economic activity, the level of car sales, will be somewhat lower in the future than in the peak years of the past, as well as that General Motors' own share of that will be smaller.
And what we were talking about, Matt, is smaller is exactly what we're going to see for General Motors, probably never the size General Motors we've seen in the past.
The share is the issue. Additionally, what General Motors has done, for better or worse, that you can't go on losing $500 million a month. This just doesn't work out. But by losing that capacity, by going from a capacity of 5.5 million cars to 4.5 million cars, you have a company which in good times will never make the kind of profits it made and can never take the kind of leadership that was based on those profits.
Who's at fault here, Claire Zempel, when we look at what state the industry is in today?
Well, I think there are many places to point blame. First of all, probably the executive suite for being slow to respond to changing markets, to changing economic necessities, getting ready to compete effectively. I've read recently that it takes General Motors 50 hours to produce a Cadillac, supposedly. Perhaps Matt has a comment on that. And it takes Ford 35 hours to produce the same quality car. That's a considerable cost disadvantage and one of the reasons that they're not able to compete at low levels of output and still survive financially.
I think those final assembly times have been overrated. The Japanese are down in the 14-15 hour category average, and GM is up in the 35, 40 hour. Ford is in the 20 hour. But if you multiply that by $17 an hour, it only describes a very small part of the problem. The problem is too much management, not good enough design, cars that are designed in a way that makes them very costly to build.
How do we bring the American consumer back to the American automobile?
I would not ask a consumer ever to spend more for an American car because it was an American car. That's a very expensive way of maintaining obsolescence. But I would say there are some very good cars in the American lines now, much better than they were years ago, and they should be judged on their merits and not the perception that it can't be any good if it was made in this country. We still make some bad cars, but there are good cars out there. If you shop, they have Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors labels on them.
It might be interesting, Claire Zempel, is will we begin to see any of what we're seeing in the American automobile industry within the Japanese automobile industry? Because they've been trying to move cars off those assembly lines to meet that American appetite.
Well, I think in time we certainly will. The world is changing very rapidly. We're seeing the emancipation of millions of people in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and perhaps eventually China, and this is going to give rise to new markets, to new producers, new low-cost producers over time. Korean automobile industry, a Chinese automobile industry, these are coming. And it will be that way, I think, for decades, if not centuries, to come.
Certainly a history lesson, Matt Joseph, when we talk about our dependence, our economic dependence on this industry all these years.
This is an industry that's 75 years old in this country. We have become completely dependent on it. One out of seven jobs basically relies on it. It's a mature industry, to say the least. It is a robust industry in other places. We should never have allowed this to happen, and we must begin to take steps to look at what there is beyond automobiles.
Okay, Claire Zempel in Milwaukee, thank you for your time this evening. Matt Joseph, thank you also.
Still to come on Weekend, thoughts on the history of welfare reform. And coming up next, some reflections on the winter season.
There's a wonderful poem by Wallace Stevens called The Snowman that begins with these words: one must have a mind of winter. And today was a day to have a mind of winter. Icy roads, rain and snow, the Midwest at its very finest. But winter can also bring with it a particular kind of beauty, especially if you venture out beyond the city limits, park the car, and go for a walk in the snowy woods. And since Sunday at 2:45 a.m. marks the winter solstice, we thought we'd apply the mind of winter to this week's weekly reader segment. George Vukalik is going to read tonight from his book, North Country Notebook, and the work of one of his favorite poets. George.
Naturalist Marion Moran says she just loves the winter woods because in the snow, it's like reading an open book. Well, it is, if you know the language. Otherwise, the scratchings and the trackings are just the melange of hieroglyphics. They're mysterious as a computer microchip on a Scrabble board. Marion also loves to stop at certain scratchings and trackings, survey them in silence, and then ask, what happened here? Every time she asks that, it reminds me of Maxine Kuhnman's poem, The Presents, not Christmas Presents, the presence that you feel and sense when someone is staring at the back of your head. Something went crabwise across the snow this morning. Something went hard and slow over our hayfield. It could have been a raccoon lugging a knapsack. It could have been a porcupine carrying a tennis racket. It could have been something supple as a red fox dragging the squawk and spatter of a crippled woodcock. 10 knuckles underground, those bones are seeds now, pure as baby's teeth. I cross on snowshoes, cunningly woven from the skin and the sinews of something else that went before.
Turn now to the subject of welfare. Recently, the state of Michigan eliminated its general relief program. That's the welfare program of last resort. It was a drastic measure, and it sent the subject of welfare reform back into the Wisconsin headlines. This week, the governor announced a number of new welfare reform initiatives. Some are designed to reduce Wisconsin's attractiveness to out-of-state claimants, and some are designed to expand previous measures like LearnFare. Will any of these proposals, though, solve the welfare dilemma? Here's a report on the coming debate over welfare reform. Will out-of-state welfare recipients soon hit the highways and head for Wisconsin? It's one of many welfare questions now up for debate at the state capitol.
I expect to hear discussion today of workfare, learnfare, bridefare, and what some fear will be a welfare migration from Michigan and other states into Wisconsin.
A newly formed legislative committee will debate all of these topics and more in the weeks ahead. They won't have an easy task. State Representative John Gard is one of the committee's Republican members.
What we're saying is we have a limited amount of dollars. And if we want those dollars to go to people that really need the help, then we have to do our best to get the people who don't need the help or who are abusing the system out of the system.
The questions now before this committee are both emotional and complex, which leads to a problem. Slogans on either side of the political aisle can easily replace substance, and complex reform measures soon become reduced to a kind of welfare shorthand. Longtime Capitol observer Dick Wheeler.
Part of the problem is the press corps itself looks for ways to shorthand things. LearnFare, bridefare, workfare, welfare. I mean, you write it down. If it fits in a headline, you use it. It automatically becomes the program. I mean, bridefare is the Parental Responsibility and Initiatives Act. It doesn't say bridefare, but we say it's bridefare, so it's bridefare.
This is the third welfare reform panel that I've been a part of, so it's been around.
State Representative Peter Barca also serves on the Welfare Committee. He believes that the welfare debate tends to repeat itself and that a conservative Republican governor may soon repeat an old Democratic mistake, throwing money at social problems.
I think that to some degree we're revisiting the 60s, where I think in the 60s perhaps we threw money into programs thinking that you were going to completely eradicate poverty without really studying how you go about that, and now perhaps we're throwing money into programs thinking that we're going to have these instantaneous cures to welfare dependency.
Let me make sure I've got this right. Are you saying Tommy Thompson is leading us back into the 60s?
Nobody would ever believe it, I'm sure, but I believe that to some degree it is true that we are starting to invest huge sums of money, in some cases, in programs that absolutely do not work.
Commitment. It's too early to tell if current welfare reform efforts will work better than the Democratic efforts of the 1960s. But to those who live in the shadow of the city, those on the front lines of the current war on poverty, the rhetoric from both sides of the state capitol gets discouraging. Kenneth Oldham is director of daycare services for children in Milwaukee.
It's frustrating to me, having been involved in this kind of thing for, you know, 23 years, and I've seen 1,000 training programs, different alphabet soup names, but the same thing happens. When I came here in 68, I forgot what it was. There were a number of federal programs that were supposed to, that were specifically addressed to the low-income and AFDC recipient. I don't think it's done anything, and here we go again.
Oldham believes that too much attention is paid to welfare and not enough to the plight of the working poor. Example, his own daycare staff earns little more than minimum wage. Not enough to put food on the table, pay rent, pay for daycare, and buy health insurance.
No one on minimum wage can afford to do that. And what they end up doing is they quit. The turnover here is tremendous, and they go back on welfare.
The cup goes on the table.
Nancy Folsom is a former welfare mother who now makes just over minimum wage as a daycare worker. She's trying to avoid a return trip to life on AFDC.
Being on the AFDC is a very humbling experience. You do get in a rut. You do get in a rut. And the highlight, well, I did, the highlight of my day was going to get the mail and watching the soap operas. And then my big thing was going to the grocery store. And when you get to it, that's not a life.
Good job.
But a life off of welfare is not easy either. Folsom clears less than $700 a month. More than half of that goes to rent. If her daycare expenses weren't covered by a special government program, she couldn't make it.
If you had to pay $90 a week for daycare, which is about the average price, I mean, if you had that plus your rent, I mean, you wouldn't eat, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. We'd be hungry, yeah. I'd probably would be over on 26th and Mineral, standing in the line, or 9th and Madison, that have those programs for the suppers. Yeah.
Or you'd have to go back on welfare.
Or back on welfare, sure.
Nancy Folsom's dilemma gets at the root of the real problem, how to make work preferable to welfare. The real task now before the legislature will be to move beyond slogans on both sides. Otherwise, the recycled debates of the past will continue well into the future.
How worried are you that 20 years from now we could be having the same conversation?
Well, I think we will be having the same conversation. I don't see anything on our horizon that's going to change that. And it pretty much would be the same thing. That's frustrating. That's frustrating.
A report on the debate coming up on welfare reform. Lynn, one other point that's worth mentioning that was talked about at the hearing at the Capitol, and that is they roughly divided those on welfare into groups of thirds instead of they're all the same, saying essentially a third are on welfare for a very short time, just a few months. Another third are on and off, like Nancy Folsom, the woman we met in that story, struggles to stay on and off of welfare. And then there's that third that is welfare dependent, the hardcore. And part of what they want to talk about at the Capitol is developing varied approaches so that you're not just coming up with a welfare reform program, but programs that can get at those
different solutions
thirds.
For the different groups. Yep. Yeah. Thanks, Dane. That's interesting. After years of debate, is the United States finally ready to embrace a national health insurance program? Well, the catalyst may be the 1992 presidential election and congressional races, where health care is expected to be a major issue. 37 million Americans certainly hope something is done. They're the estimated number of people who have no health insurance. One of the plans getting most of the attention is the one co-sponsored by Wisconsin Democratic Congressman Jim Moody, which would guarantee health care for every American and still reportedly cut costs by 40%. Congressman Moody joins us live now from Milwaukee with details of his health care plan. Welcome to you, Congressman Moody.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let me begin first with what seems to be a question of how can we provide health care to every American and somehow cut the costs of what we're spending now?
Well, because we spend a lot of money on things that don't really improve health, but really go into administration. 25% of health care dollars in America go strictly for paperwork, overhead, bill collecting, and all the sort of things that could be drastically cut if we were willing to go to a single-payer system, such as a number of Scandinavian, German, and Canadians have done. And that would cut cost a lot. The other thing about a single-payer system is that it would give the purchasers of the health care, such as the provinces in Canada or the work groups in Germany, market clout vis-a-vis the providers, hospitals, physicians, so that the fees that they negotiate could be reasonable, but would not soar at 15 to 25% per year, which is what we're seeing now. So for those two main reasons, we could save, according to a GAO study, $67 billion a year by going to single payer, which would be enough to cover every American. That would take about $19 billion of it. And then even eliminate co-payments and deductibles if you chose to do that. And I think there's a strong argument to do that or make them very small and still have money left over. So it's one of those very rare situations where you can actually expand services and cut total government costs if and only if, however, you're willing to go to a single-payer system instead of the proliferation of healthcare insurance companies that we now have.
I was just going to say, so consequently, if it looks so good on paper, then why the opposition? Why has it taken so long for us to move in that direction? As you mentioned, other countries have this sort of a national health care program, and it's working, apparently.
Well, it is working.
Who opposes it, Congressman? Where's the problem in this?
Well,
the public wants it.
70% of the public says they would go to something like a national health care, even if it were government insured and managed. That's unusual, given today's general feeling about government. It shows how far we have come and how bad the situation has gotten. Most Americans now feel their own health care coverage is either inadequate or does not have enough limits or may be canceled on them, or they'll lose it if they change jobs. All of those things make our system very, very questionable. And I think all these trends that we're seeing have exploded over the last few years. Healthcare costs are climbing in America, double-digit rates, far faster than anything else. And corporations in America have really begun to recognize that they cannot compete internationally if they don't bring healthcare costs under control. And it's become a question of jobs. It has always been a humane issue. Are we going to allow children? Are we going to allow working Americans who pay taxes and are responsible to go without health care, as we have been doing? That's a humane question, but there's also a question now, is it going to cost us jobs if we don't make the kind of changes that most other countries have made, namely go to some kind of single-payer system to bring cost under control, expand coverage to include everyone? And one of the main reasons to do that is if you include everyone, you can bring costs down for a third reason I didn't mention in my opening statement, namely you stress prevention. Only when people are covered entirely, all people are covered, do they go in early and find out what that lump in their breast is or what that pain in their groin is or what that thing that won't go, symptom that won't go away. And since we don't have, since we don't cover people for those kind of early checkups, and we don't cover a lot of people at all, they come in later and sicker and end up costing us much, much more.
Congressman, one of the opposing arguments, and I would like you to still address the question about who's keeping this from happening, if it's so wonderful, but one of the opposing arguments is that if you go to the single payer, that single payer is the government, and the government would operate this with about as much compassion as they do the IRS. I mean, that you know, you don't want to have big government running the nation's health care system. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, government wouldn't run the health care system. The system I'm proposing would remain in the private sector, fee-for-service medicine. Hospitals would remain just as they are, either charity or private or county or public. None of that would change. The government would just be the ultimate insurer, the way they are the ultimate insurer for Social Security. Social Security is actually well-run. It has less than 1% overhead. It's a government program, but it works very well. It's very popular. It does what it's supposed to do.
So is that just kind of a boogeyman in your view, the idea that that this will be some sort of big government thing?
Well, because people think that we're proposing that government run medicine. We're not. Doctors would remain in the private sector, and so would all the hospitals. But the insurance, or rather the reinsurance function, would become a government function, and that would cut away a lot of the necessary paperwork. If you've tried to have over 1,000 different Social Security systems, the way we have 1,000 different health insurance systems, you would have an awful lot of paperwork, and Social Security would not have a 1 or 2% overhead. It would have a 25% overhead the way healthcare has, and that would be very inefficient. So while we like private competition, it's a very important force to keep costs down. It doesn't work in this case because we have such a few number of health insurers or health providers in any one location. We need clout of a single purchaser to negotiate reasonable and contain fees and costs.
So again, who's fighting this wondrous thing then? I mean, is it doctors? Is it malpractice attorneys? Who is it?
No, it's not that. The AMA is now supports universal health care. They haven't decided whether they want a single payer or multiple payer system. I prefer the singles, you know. What's been happening is that these trends, these explosive cost trends, have been accelerating, and I think people now are coming to recognition that they really didn't have before, that this is not sustainable. We cannot have healthcare climbing at double-digit rates while everything else up is going very slowly and keep paying for it and we can't compete with foreigners. And this recognition is finally sinking in. It's the Fortune 500 companies that are now coming to us in Congress and saying, do something. We cannot live with this.
Quickly, Congressman Moody, as far as the upcoming election, we saw Harris-Wolford certainly prove in Pennsylvania that health care can be an issue to win an election. Is it going to play as big nationally as it did in the state of Pennsylvania?
Well, I think it's an issue whose time has come, and I'm glad that I've been working on it for several years, because I think it's now ripe for passage in Congress, and I think it should be the center of a political campaign because it affects our quality of life and affects millions of people. So I think it'll be central to the presidential race, and I think it'll be central to a lot of other races. Harris-Wofford's race, I think, was a wake-up call for a lot of political people, and I think you'll see candidates having to decide, do they support national health care or not? There's no way to go and hide on that one anymore.
Congressman, I'm sorry we've got to wrap it up there, but I've got to ask you before you go if you're sorry that Mario Cuomo is out of the race.
No, I'm not sorry. I'm glad he's not in the race. I'm glad the candidates who are out there running now are going to be apparently the brace of candidates that we're going to be looking at for the next number of months.
All right. Jim Moody, thanks.
If you'd like to comment on this week's edition of Weekend, call us at 1-800-253-1158. That's 1-800-253-1158.
For the past year, a number of major American universities have been rocked with charges that they improperly billed the federal government for indirect research expenses. At Stanford University, for example, President Donald Kennedy eventually resigned in part over that billing debacle. Now it's the University of Wisconsin's turn to face the auditor's music, and this week the Audit Bureau released its report. It showed that the UW may have improperly billed the government for $4.5 million in so-called indirect research costs, items ranging from everything to the cost of public relations to the cost of flowers. How serious are those charges? Two differing views of that now from Charlie Sykes, author and frequent critic of the UW system. Charlie, welcome. And John Torfey, who is an associate vice chancellor. Charlie, I suspect that you think this is yet another in the long list of sins of the University of Wisconsin system.
Well, I don't think you need to take my word for it. You just need to look at Dale Catnaugh's report. I think Dale Catnaugh has shown why he's the best investigative reporter in Wisconsin about
this. The state
this.
Auditor. Yeah.
I think that it's up to the federal government to determine how whether illegalities or rules are broken. But I think that we in Wisconsin can be very clear about questioning the wisdom and the judgment and the management skill that this audit revealed. The fact that you're using $3,000 of federal money as indirect costs in research to buy flowers, the fact that you're using the money to have dinners and receptions for the alumni, or that you even use it for commencement. And of course, the biggest example of UW chutzpah of all, charging 90% of the lobbying and PR flack operation of the UW to the federal government. It appears that Santa Claus comes to the University of Wisconsin all year round.
For the defense, John Torfey.
It's a nice rhetorical flourish, but it isn't reality. That isn't what the Audit Bureau said. What they said was the state incurred these costs, and then we claimed them as reimbursement. And what the auditors found, including Dale Catnaugh, was that over a period of time, there were some costs that we billed for which were unallowable. There were an equal amount of costs which we didn't bill for which were allowable. And we got precisely the appropriate rate.
Let's spend a moment more on that, John.
Well, that's not exactly what he said.
Yes, it is.
Let's spend a moment more on that. The report did show that the university actually could have asked for more and did not. So it almost sounds like you were wrong on two counts. I mean, you did some things you shouldn't have, and you did some things you shouldn't have.
It's sort of darned if you do and darned if you don't. Essentially, what they found was that the rate that we have, which is 5 years old, was negotiated 5 years at a predetermined amount of 44%. They found that we reported costs which exceeded that amount. We reported about $2.7 million more than we needed to claim that. Out of the total of all the costs we reported, they found $4.5 million that was unallowable. Essentially, $2.7 million of that didn't have any effect. We were never reimbursed for it.
Let's be as clear as we can to the people watching about what this is all about. Because it does sound funny, John Torfey, that it's somehow allowable when you have a research grant from the federal government to then say there are these indirect costs of having flowers in the president's residence. I mean,
it sounds funny because it is funny.
It's silly. It never should have happened, but it was an allowable cost which the federal government, as Charlie indicated, will have to determine. They said entertainment expenses up until October 1, 1991, were allowable expenses.
Well,
should they have? No. Should the state not have claimed them because they were allowable and because we think it's as silly as it is? No, we claimed them. We got criticized in part for not claiming other things that
That's half true. I think that the federal government has clarified its rules. It didn't change the rules. I think that a lot of people recognize that it was clearly never intended that you would wine and dine alumni or buy flowers or pay for the housekeeper to clean out the president's bathtub with federal indirect research costs. And you didn't need federal guidelines to tell you that was wrong. And I think that, unfortunately, what you're seeing is an institutional arrogance here that the university does not feel that the rules that apply to other units of government necessarily apply to them. And this idea that that you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, I think is quite misleading. I think what you're seeing is sloppiness at both ends, charging certain costs that clearly never should have been charged, but also clearly raising substantial questions, I believe, about the management of the university. And I think we've seen a kind of an amusing interchange this week where you had a vice president of the system pointing the finger at Donna Shalala's office and Donna Shalala pointing back. And in the past, I've referred to UW as an empire of waste. I think what this audit shows is it's also an empire of sloppiness.
It may well be a case, from your perception, Charlie, of arrogance. What I'm really saying is not arrogance. There were things that we included as costs which shouldn't have been there. But more importantly, there were a series of things which the federal government said were claimable. And those were specifically stated. And in October, what the federal government said was, as of October 1, 1991, we can't claim entertainment anymore. We could before.
Well,
should we not have?
Let's talk about what we can learn from this, what the UW ought to do differently in terms of not only what it should and ought to do, but the kind of image it wants to portray to the people of this state. What have you been talking about, John Torfey, up on Bascom Hill?
That's the basic problem. It does present a bad image. And it's a public relations, you know, not nightmare, but it's a public relations difficulty. But the question becomes, what, as you said, what can we learn from it? What we can learn from it is, as part of the next rate negotiations, we've got to look harder at what we're including and what not. Not only of what's allowable, but what's publicly acceptable.
So looking at, in the end, really what's sort of the right thing to do, simplistically, but the right thing to do.
Right.
But that's not a public relations problem. And unfortunately, the UW always tends to see all of these things as simply a public relations problem. They're substance problems. And I think this goes much deeper. I think the UW now has a serious credibility problem with the legislature. This is not the only audit to find that money had not been spent in the way that the legislature had been led to believe it had been spent.
This
is not something that a few PR people are going to do something with. It's going to be something more fundamental and a more fundamental, I think, introspection on the part of UW.
Well, Charlie, you've been a PR man in your life. Now, come on.
No, I never have.
Well, you provided consulting advice to the county executive over there. Give a little advice here. Give a little advice to John Torfey.
Well, I think that, first of all, is that the UW ought to admit that it is fallible like everybody else. That it should abide by the same rules and not consist to auditors and legislators, oh, we're different than everybody else, you don't understand us, well, we're the UW. And I think that that you're going to need to see a top-down investigation. I think perhaps the legislature is going to have to lead it into the management practices of the university system, because clearly they do not seem to be prepared to move or to reform their practices until they are pushed either by the auditor or by the legislature. And maybe that's where the leadership has to come.
John Torfey, the last word is yours.
We've reformed the practices. We've taken over at looking at this. We've asked the audit bureau to come in and take the look. They came in and took the look and told us what the results would be from their analysis. We intend to negotiate based on their analysis.
John Torfey, Associate Vice Chancellor of the UW. Thank you. Charlie Sykes, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Weekend, a year-end look at the Packers' woeful season, and our political panel reviews the week's news.
Sunday.
the season to be jolly, but the Green Bay Packers season has been anything but. The team has suffered its worst season in years, something which may cost Coach Lindy Infante his job. The only holiday gift the Packers offered their fans this year was a bad case of the blahs. One of those who suffered mightily was reporter Rob Krybeck of WEAU-TV News Center 13 in Eau Claire. Why did the Packers turn Rob green? Here's tonight's local listings report.
Oh, my aching head. What seems to be the problem here?
I'm just not feeling very good, Doc. Chills, fever, upset stomach. It's really bad on Sundays.
Open your mouth. Say ah. Aha. You've got Infante's infirmity. It's commonly known as the Packer plague.
But, Doc, I've got Packer Viking tickets for Saturday.
You'll have to sell those tickets.
Two Packer tickets, 50-yard line, $50.
Come on, come on.
$50?
No. $20, what do you think?
I'm from Minnesota. Why would I want Packers tickets?
Merry Christmas. I can't get away from this.
And Cleary, having trouble, loose ball. Detroit looks to have recovered.
Pick it up. Lombardi, where are you?
Eternal optimist, there's always, of course, next season. And that's right, we'll see. Let's go back to our political group here and rejoining us once again, Ed Garvey and Bill Dixon, and our guest panelist, Steve King. Let's talk a little bit about what Dave really folded into a fairly long segment, because the problem is so immense, and that's welfare. We are trying to get a grab on this problem here in Wisconsin, Steve King, and we seem to be at a loss as to which direction to go. What do you see as the direction that we must head if we're going to nip this problem?
Well, it is a problem. I'm kind of fascinated by the way this whole thing has unfolded. You know, Governor Thompson, I think to his credit, three or four years ago, really began some what I call laboratory issues in the area of welfare, learn fare, work fare, those kind of things. And here we are 4 years later, move the clock up 4 years, and now Michigan, Illinois, Minnesota are taking some initiatives, and we're kind of pointing, saying, there they go, we must catch them, for we are their leader. I think some of the things that the two-tier system, some of the things that we're seeing coming out are long overdue.
Some would suggest what's happening in Michigan is radical, not reform, but radical, in just cutting people loose, saying, find a job.
General, able-bodied men.
Well, but that's the problem. You're talking about a small percentage of people who are on welfare who are able-bodied and who are trying to avoid work. All the studies indicate that people on welfare want to work, but the basic problem we have is that they don't have health care and they don't have jobs. So, you know, the focus is on welfare as if it's their fault. When we're looking at General Motors moving jobs to Mexico and Ford and Chrysler, I mean, Lee Iacocca is more responsible for welfare problems in this state because of what he did with Chrysler and Kenosha, than any of the poor people on welfare. I mean, this is the problem. We keep the focus on the wrong end of the economic spectrum, and Bill and I were talking about it before.
Well, you're right, Ed. Some people are trying to decouple welfare from having more children and approach it as a way to deal with health care and education, et cetera. But unfortunately, who controls the agenda in these presidential election years? And that's politicians. And there's no question that the Republican strategists are going to try and use this as a wedge issue to drive a wedge between the middle class and the lower class, because it's easier to attack someone on the bottom rung of the ladder, when in fact the middle class and the lower class should be together in this presidential election talking about the people who stole our national treasure for the last 11 years. And it's going to be used as a political issue, and that's a shame, but we expect it from these people every 4 years.
So how does that bring us reform?
Well, it doesn't. 13 states have cut AFDC. 7 states this year have cut general assistance. There are some good proposals out there. Wisconsin's different. We're approaching this seriously. Wally Konicki, the Assembly Speaker, appointed that panel. Governor Thompson's got the proposal. I think we'll be serious about it here. But let's face it, it has Willie Horton potential nationwide for the election, and the Republican strategists know it.
Steve King, do the Republicans, in terms of pure politics here, Bill's right in a sense that this is a very good political issue. It's been good for the governor. He's achieved national acclaim for those laboratory kinds of experiments. It's not bad necessarily for this to be good politics, is it?
No, I think that's one of the bonuses that comes out of it. I think what's clearly happened here is the so-called welfare magnet thing has become a political magnet thing, and I like the way it's turned. The burden of proof is on liberals.
Except that
the burden of proof is on liberals to show why we shouldn't bring reasonableness back to welfare.
But Steve, you know and I know that what happens is every time we get near an election, you get the Republicans saying, uh-oh, here they come up from Illinois. Now we got Tommy Thompson in an almost bizarre idea that somehow they're flowing in from Michigan up at Marinette to get our attention off the fact.
There is evidence that there are more new out-of-state claimants in Milwaukee County. 20%
True story.
20% of people filing for welfare now in Milwaukee County are new to the state. That's significant.
True story. A person took a bus from Illinois to Milwaukee here in the last month, took a cab from the bus station to the Milwaukee County Welfare Office, walked in, saw a lot of people, and went up to somebody and said, yep, where's the line for the people from Illinois?
But here's your hypocrisy. You say we can't have a federal solution, it ought to be run by the states because you know that's what's going to happen, and then you say that those states that treat their people a little bit better, then you blame them for somehow being humane. Why don't you agree to have some kind of national standards, national health care, take care of the problems, create some jobs, but you don't want to do that, and you don't want to say to your business friends, stop sending your jobs to Mexico, start keeping your jobs here. Then you'd have fewer welfare problems.
You're a dinosaur, Ed. We're not moving in the way of union and single payer, all these euphemisms. We're working toward commonwealths, common good. Keep the state's laboratories where these things can be tested. And I like what Governor Thompson's doing in terms of Wisconsin Laboratory.
The Thompson administration's own figures presented to the legislature shows we will not save a penny with a two-year experiment on a two-tier welfare program. It will cost $644,000 to monitor it. We'll save $577,000. It costs us money to go to a two-tier system, and they're going to sell it as a way of dealing with the budget deficit. Steve, some people of goodwill are trying to do this, but let's face it, it's tainted by the politics.
I don't like these people taking literally the fact that you're among friends in Wisconsin, coming and taking our money unnecessarily.
Let's switch gears because we're talking about programs. Let's talk about health care for a moment. We heard Jim Moody talking about a plan that is probably receiving more attention than any of the others, although there are 50 different health plans that have surfaced somewhere in Washington. Is this a year it might happen? Bill Dixon?
Well, Congressman Moody made it sound like nobody opposes this.
That's what he said.
I'm still kind of baffled by
this. I oppose it.
You all right, Steve King opposes it. All right.
One
why is it,
why, who's the dinosaur?
Why is it, yeah. Why is it a bad thing, Steve?
Because the issue isn't health care. It's health cost.
And, wait a minute. 37 million people don't have health care in this country. That's not a health care issue?
87 to 90% do.
So you don't care about the 30
sure
million?
Sure, I do. Adults? Sure, I do. There's got to be a safety net, and I think there is a safety net. How many hospitals turn people away for major emergencies? I think darn few.
Well,
the issue is health care costs. It's cost. And to say that somehow the government's going to reduce that
cost
is ludicrous.
How do the people do that? Let's say, how do we try to control costs
employers,
without kind of a single plan?
Employers do it.
Oh, nonsense. You know what they're
no,
doing?
No.
Shifting
employers
the
do
cost
it.
To the employees.
Employers and the individual do it.
The
problem with health care costs is that the users don't pay.
You're saying you don't want to say...
The users don't pay.
Sure they do.
Believe
they pay
it.
In lower wages.
And they're not going to pay in the government's case either.
The government says trust us with the health care system. You're saying business is saying trust us?
No, I'm saying that trust the individual employer to work out a system whereby the individual has some responsibility for choosing his health care and paying for it. And there's all kinds of, I don't think we have time to go into it. I'd love to propose there's different tax treatments that we can put in. There's
it'll help the accountants.
It might.
Follow
That's
me
good.
And I'll take care of both of your concerns. Follow me. The average family of four in this state next year is going to pay $10,000 for health care, $4,000 for the savings and loan bailout, $6,000 to defend us against the Soviet Union, which doesn't exist anymore. For a family of four in Wisconsin, that's $20,000 on health care, defense, and the SNL bailout. And that's after-tax dollars. Jerry Brown, unfortunately, is a flawed messenger, but it's about time we threw most of these people out. Middle class and poor people are hurting, and there's a certain segment in this society that gains from this misery.
Let's talk Jim Moody's government's got the answer.
All right. Let's talk finally about those middle-class people who, 74,000 of whom, will lose their jobs over the next 4 years because of the GM cutbacks. We seem to be fortunate in this state. Janesville probably is going to be protected. But what's going on out there? And Ed, don't unions bear some responsibility for the loss of those jobs?
Absolutely. They deserve some responsibility because they haven't been effective in forcing some sensible government policies that would stop big business from moving jobs to Mexico, Taiwan, and wherever else they can get substandard wages. I mean, but it's not because of the high wages. The unions have been totally ineffective in the last 10 years in getting higher wages. The problem you have now is the greed of people at General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford, who when they had a chance, when the yen and the dollar were at a favorable position for us, instead of lowering the prices, recapturing their share of the market, they took these huge profits. Now we're the chickens are coming home to roost. So what we've got, unfortunately, is irresponsible management.
Stronger unions would make the world better, says Ed Garvey. Steve?
Stronger unions are certainly part of the problem. I think they've been very effective in bullying corporate management over the years and presenting, at least creating part of the problem that we have today. But I'm struck and fascinated by the fact that we're whining over the fact that 70-some thousand GM workers may lose their jobs over the next 4 years. But we applaud the fact that Dick Cheney is going to eliminate 450,000 employees, more than GM ever thought of ever having
Defense
over the next
Department
4 years.
Employees.
We don't yeah,
applaud
through the peace dividend.
I don't applaud that.
And
I'd like to get rid of 900,000 of them.
Those people don't have the 95% union benefit over the next 3 years when they're laid off.
So what are you going to do?
These people are out on the street.
Why don't we?
We need to create more capital so that entrepreneurs can create more jobs to keep these
people
employed.
You know what we should do? Why don't we cut the taxes of the rich? That's an idea.
Oh, sure.
Sounds like a segment for another day.
I'm glad you came.
Yeah, thank you. I think you'll be invited back. A little spontaneity here. Thank you. Thank you all. Bill Dixon, Steve King for stopping in and spending some time. Come on back again. And Ed Garvey, of course, thank you too. We do want to mention that since this is the holiday period, we will not be on for, 2 weeks from today.
We'll be back on January the 3rd, and we'll talk about what's going to be making news in 1992.
Okay. Everybody have yourself a good weekend. Thanks for joining us. Good night.